You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 14th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, 1973, Skylab is launched into space.
On this day?
And it was the last launch of the Saturn V rocket.
No way. Oh, how sad. I love the Saturn V.
Steve, you saw the Saturn V rocket on your last trip to Florida, right?
Yes. They had one pretty much assembled. I mean, it was pulled apart in a couple of places, but immense, absolutely immense.
It's jaw-dropping.
You can't appreciate how big it is unless you're actually next to one of these things.
It was jaw-dropping. It reminded me, my reaction was somewhat similar to when I saw David, the statue of David, for the first time in Florence. You're just in awe and utter shock at just how gorgeous that thing is. Amazing. So huge. Too bad we don't build more of them because it would come in handy.
Don't sound bitter. Don't sound bitter, Bob.
Okay. All right.
Well, we got a lot of news and emails to get through this week, and we have an interview coming up later in the show with Martin, who's a Swedish archaeologist and the author of Aardvarkeology, a science blog. But first, some news. First news item, Einstein letter shows disdain for religion. So recently, one of Einstein's letters has come to light, revealing some of the great Albert Einstein's attitudes, at least later in life, towards religion. Evan, you looked into this.
Yeah, this letter is going to be auctioned this week in London. It was part of a private collection for more than 50 years. And, you know, it had some very interesting things to say. It was written in 1954, which was the year before Einstein died. He was obviously in quite a reflective mood, as many of his writings from that time indicated. And he penned the letter in 1954 to the philosopher Erich Gutkind, or Gutkind, who had sent Einstein a copy of his book to read, and I guess this was Einstein's sort of response to Gutkind. And amongst the things that are said in the letter were, and I quote, "For me, the Jewish religion, like all others, is an incarnation of the most childish superstitions, and the Jewish people, to whom I gladly belong and whose mentality I have a deep affinity, have no different quality for me than all other people. As far as my experience goes, they are no better than any other human groups, although they are protected from the worst cancers by a lack of power. Otherwise, I cannot see anything chosen about them." And he goes on, mm-hmm. Obviously to say some more things about basically his disbelief in a god that has interest in the day-to-day lives of individual human beings. He certainly really never felt that way as far as God goes. There was, in reading some other things about Einstein throughout his life, he did have a sense of religion, but it was his own, and it was in the harmony of the overall harmony of the universe, the greater mysteries that we can perhaps never truly discover. He felt the immensity and humility in front of that sort of awesomeness. And to him, he defined that as his God. Not an individual God who listens to the individual prayers of people or any given group of people, right?
He used the word God as a shorthand, and he clearly did not believe in a personal God, as you say.
Yeah, and the reason why this letter is so interesting is because his words are so often twisted by people with agendas on the religious side of things, usually creationists and whatnot. His words are taken out of context and used to lead people to believe that Einstein was a very religious person, which he wasn't.
Right. Astrologers have done that too, tried to make it seem like he was a closet astrologer. I mean, it's the Albert Einstein, his name is iconic, right? He represents science and genius. So everyone wants to have him on their side. It's kind of an argument from authority. It's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other quote that I think has captured a lot of attention is this part of the letter where he writes, "The word God is for me nothing more than the expression and product of human weakness, the Bible a collection of honorable but still primitive legends which are nevertheless pretty childish." That pretty much puts his beliefs into clear focus. And also say that, Evan, I know you completed the book. I'm halfway through the book, Einstein, which is written by Walter Isaacson. And we will be interviewing him in a couple of weeks. Usually, I don't talk about future interviews too much because, you know, the schedule is often in flux. But since we're talking about it this week, I'll mention in a couple of weeks we'll be having a very long discussion about Albert Einstein. And we'll go into this in much more detail. Jay, you wrote on your blog today about the Vatican and space aliens, which is not two words you're used to hearing in the same sentence. But Jay, why don't you tell us what you wrote?
Yeah, I was totally shocked on this one. The director of the Vatican Observatory, Jose Gabriel Funes, I think is the pronunciation of his name.
Yeah, he's like the astronomer to the Pope, right?
Yeah, and I couldn't see if he actually had any real station, like if he was a priest or, you know, where he would be. But definitely, you know, he's the current guy that speaks about the world of, you know, the cosmos and everything. And he was interviewed by the Vatican's daily newspaper, and he came out with all this information. You know, a lot of the claims that he was making were that, you know, there could be aliens. If they do exist, there's no reason why we would really need to discount them as God's creation, because everything is in God's creation, and that he believes, right, like we shouldn't limit the breadth of God's power, like how, you know, the domain of God and everything. So he was really talking about the fact that these are just other animals that God created. And he said if they're, you know, if they're sentient, they may not even be involved in the whole Adam and Eve sin situation. Like they could be void of sin.
Free from original sin.
Yeah.
Lucky aliens. Because
they didn't eat the apple, right?
No.
I didn't eat an apple either.
So he just came out with all these facts that seemed to be kind of off the cuff to me. And I said in my blog, I think that there's going to be a, you know, a time of reckoning where some of these statements might need to be altered or retracted. But overall, it was very weird information from where I sit, coming from the Vatican, you know, commenting about aliens.
Well, they're just trying to stay current.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, there are – one of the things we like to talk about is what would happen if – knowledge of alien, you know, spacefaring race visiting the Earth, you know, became public. What would be the reaction? Specifically, what would be the reaction of the various religious communities? So, in a way, they're sort of thinking a thought experiment. What about that? The Catholics, and you know, they're with their interpretation of Christianity and the Bible, there really is no reason why they would not believe in alien intelligent races. You know, they could incorporate that into their belief system. Although the fundamentalist Christians would have a serious problem with that, which I knew from my various conversations with fundamentalists over the years, but I also just looked up to see what was on the web. And if you go to ChristianAnswers.net, they have an article on what the Bible says about intelligent life on other planets. Uh-huh. And there's a couple of basic points that they make. One is that the Bible says that there is God, the angels, man, and animals, and that's it. So any life on any other planets would have to be unintelligent life. So there could not be any intelligent life on other planets. And the second thing is that when Judgment Day comes, when the time of that we're in right now is over, and what God will do is he'll destroy the earth and all of creation and then remake paradise, you know, for all the good people, right? So when that happens, the stars will fall from the heavens. So if there's any life up there, they're going to be killed and destroyed at that moment. All life in the entire universe will be destroyed.
I hate when that happens.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems like an awful waste. You know, you got hundreds of...
Oh, have you even read the Bible?
This is what they're saying.
Come on, though. Like, that's nothing to God. Like, he could wipe out, you know, a whole poppy field of babies and, you know...
Yeah, but we're talking about hundreds of billions of galaxies.
I mean, that's... Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, read the Bible. He's kind of a jerk, okay?
Well, I mean, but Steve, that goes back to the church putting man at the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. And we've definitely drifted away from that notion, you know, over the past, what, 1,000 years, slow shift, especially since since all the scientific discoveries that have come out. I mean, obviously, we're not the center of the universe, and the church kind of doesn't really comment on stuff like that anymore, right? You don't hear them talking about it.
I mean, the Catholic Church, yeah. Well, that's a good point, Jane. That's what I was going to say that as well, that is the you could, you know, it's so obvious that the Bible was written from the perspective of people who were primitive, in that they thought that the earth was the center of the universe and that the stars were just points of light that were not very far away and not very big. They had no concept of how, you know, monumentally huge the universe was. So, you know, the stories that they're telling are from that perspective. What's absurd is for a modern day person with modern scientific knowledge to try to fit it into this, you know, primitive storytelling that took place thousands of years ago. The other UFO story in the news is from the UK. This has to do with the Ministry of Defense releasing more archives on their UFO sightings.
Cool.
You know, whenever, you know, governments release their secret UFO records, it's always really boring. You know, it's a bunch of nothing. You know, I remember, I think it was in the 90s when the Russia did it, you know, the secret UFO files of the former Soviet Union. It hasn't, there's nothing in there. It's just, it's all.
The U.S. did it last year. Half of it was redacted.
France did it recently as well.
Well, that, yeah, that always gets the conspiracy theorists going. I mean, the redaction is because, you know, a lot of this is information based upon our spying, you know, and you can't release the information without revealing our spy network and the fact that we're listening in on this country and we're spying on that country. So that's
like Roswell, because we were spying on the Soviet nuclear tests with the
exactly. We were spying on the Project Mogul was us spying on Soviet nuclear testing. So we didn't want to make that public.
Exactly like Roswell.
Exactly.
Well, way to go. You just made it public, Steve.
Yeah. Well, the government made it public, whatever, in the 90s. Yeah, there's always like it's secret Air Force or, you know, new secret test airplanes, whatever. Of course, there's tons of secrecy in the military and the government. And it just creates the opportunity for conspiracy theorists to, you know, to read whatever they want behind the black lines that are written in the documents that are released.
Yeah, right.
But the United Kingdom has their own Freedom of Information Act, and this is where all this new information is coming out of FOI requests. Nothing significant. However, a couple of points that were made. One is there's like 5 to 10% of sightings that remained unidentified.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. So there's always that residue, right? In a world without aliens, there would still be a 5 to 10% unexplained sightings. Because as we've discussed before, you can't necessarily always reverse engineer or figure out what something was. You may just not have enough information to do that. And lots of weird things can happen that you'd never be able to explain from scanty information.
Like that time I tried to recreate my mom's gingerbread cookies and my oven exploded.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what I was saying. the other point that was made in reviewing these records is that the government and the military, the UK military, were not very interested in pursuing these reports. So they got a lot of reports that they did not follow up on very enthusiastically because they were lame. You know, so I saw this spot in the sky. Okay, thank you. They wrote it down. They never, you know, sent people out to investigate it.
I love the drawing of the UFO that the two police officers made. It looks like a kindergartner. Oh, yeah.
It's a classic flying saucer. Yeah.
Did you see the statistic though that they put out there as part of this article? Back in 1999, they took a survey that 49% of the UK population believe that life exists on other planets, which is okay. 29% believe that aliens had already visited Earth in flying saucers. 29%.
Dirty.
But the other thing that's interesting is how little a splash this news is making, in my opinion.
Excellent. I think that
UFO sightings and beliefs tend to wax and wane. I think we're in the middle of a lull right now. I don't think people are that interested in UFOs this decade for whatever reason. Right? It's kind of boring, you know?
No good UFO movies out there to stir up the imaginations of people?
I guess not. Not at the moment.
You know, like when Close Encounters came out in the late 70s.
Right. Now, it probably will take a new generation coming up that hasn't heard all the same old lame stories over and over again. Because let's face it, they got nothing new to say. You know, in the 70s, there was a big resurgence because of the alien abduction
right.
addition to the mythology. They haven't added anything to the mythology recently, so there's really – it's boring.
The question becomes, though, why do these channels, History Channel and others, continuously replay these, you know, alien stories and UFO story documentaries?
Probably because it's cheap and easy and the audience is already there.
Yeah, it's just
– The History Channel is a serious misnomer. They just need to change it to
– The pseudo-History Channel?
Yeah.
It's still a base level of interest.
if I have to see that fellow from Mexico, this doctor who's this UFO expert on one more doc, I forget his name, but if I have to see his face and hear him again, I think I'm gonna go nuts. He's on every one of those crackpot shows. You know this guy that's got the beard? I can't even remember his name, but
Michael Shermer?
Not quite.
Oh. No, but seriously, he's on every one of those too.
He is. He's the skeptic who gets called up because he's in California. You know,
it's always he's right there.
He's well
it's always
he's
20 seconds.
Yeah,
15 to 20 seconds of Michael, and then
he's told me he's done hundreds of those.
Oh,
hundreds.
Yeah. Bob, tell us about the conspiracy theories swarming around the recent earthquake in China.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone's heard about the devastating quake. Pretty nasty stuff out there. Thousands confirmed dead. Many think the numbers can rise to the tens of thousands, which I think it probably will. I've heard stories about the expectation that they go to these little villages in these small towns and that they think everyone's just going to be toast. I keep getting a flashback of the tsunami from a few years ago every day. Remember the number got bigger and bigger and bigger. I was like, oh, man, I hope it doesn't happen in this case.
Right. And these numbers are dwarfed by the cyclone that hit Myanmar, which has killed over 100,000. And the worst fears are, because the government is inept and paranoid, that deaths there may exceed a million. It's just incredible to even think about those kind of numbers.
And as an aside, no psychic predicted either of them.
That's true.
But
it's true. Well said, Bob.
So some bizarre stories are coming out of China as people try to find a scapegoat or a way that it could have been prevented. So I'm not surprised that some conspiracy theories seem to be appearing, although I think this is inherently less likely than other scenarios, since natural disasters are less amenable to nefarious human schemes because they're natural. I mean, how do you say the Americans caused the earthquake? You can't.
Global warming.
There you go. So one blogger wrote that more than a month ago, he went to his local earthquake research center. Wow, I wouldn't even know where to look for my local earthquake research center. Several times he went there, several times to report that his animals had been disturbed and restless. He says that they not only ridiculed me, they accused me of making up stories. So I'm sure they were laughing at this guy pretty hard.
Yeah, but who's laughing now, huh?
Right.
Other bloggers. The thing is, how many times did he do that and there was no earthquake?
Yeah, right? That's true.
I mean, these probably have a steady stream of losers saying, oh, my left toe aches. We're going to have an earthquake, you know. Yeah,
right.
Thank you.
Right. It's confirmation bias. Afterwards, it's always, oh, yeah, my animal was acting a little weird too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it must be psychic.
Other bloggers have been writing about a silly rumor that a Chinese geologist actually predicted the quake in advance, but he'd been quieted by the authorities and his own fear, apparently. One blogger wrote regarding that, on the 7th of May, a geologist predicted this earthquake, but he didn't dare make it public. So I wonder how did he hear about it then? This guy didn't go public. Was he his buddies with this guy?
No, he heard it from his cousin's sister's brother.
There you go. The other big theme is migrating animals. On May 10th, the West China Metropolis Daily reported that hundreds of migrating toads descended upon the streets of Menyang, the second largest city in the province nearby the epicenter of the quake. And in Miansu, 60 miles from the epicenter, bloggers are talking about reports a few weeks ago before the earthquake about a mass migration of more than 1 million butterflies. Then, my favorite quote, Dr. Raymond Stantz claims, and I quote, I was present at an undersea unexplained mass sponge migration. Wait, no, sorry, that was a
sponge?
Ghost. That was a Ghostbusters movie quote. How did that get in my notes? That's it. That's all I got.
Oh, you card.
Okay, so, you know, Bob, I've heard this before about, you know, animals.
The sponge migration?
And amongst them, you know, animals having this, whatever, precognition or something that some big disaster is happening. Have we talked about this before, and is there anything to that?
There's nothing to it.
Right. It's
all animals can predict earthquakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Slick, Ray Beard, oh, I'm going to get his name wrong, Beardorfer, he's a friend of Randy's, and he's given talks at TAM in the past and did tours of Red Rocks and stuff. He's this really great geologist and such a cool guy, and he gave a wonderful talk about summing up all the research that he could find on animals predicting earthquakes. And his finding was that there was just absolutely nothing to it.
Yeah.
That there was no credible evidence to suggest that an animal could accurately predict an earthquake.
Well, what were they thinking? The animals were able to pick up on something that we can't?
Yeah, it's not totally unreasonable. It could be hearing infrasound or ultrasound or whatever that we were
right.
of the, you know, the strain right. on the rocks, you know, right before an earthquake. It's not, you don't have to believe in magic to hypothesize that there may be
right.
some mechanism there. But it turns out, as Rebecca says, it's probably just all confirmation bias.
Bob, they stated that 1 million butterflies moved out of the region because of the earthquake.
More than 1 million.
Because
before
of the
earthquake.
Yeah, before the
– yeah. Was counting those.
They could sense it, and they didn't want to, you know, get hurt, so they left.
So – but those butterflies doing that have dramatically changed the weather like 100 years
from now.
Good one, Jay. I didn't think of that.
1 million butterflies. My goodness.
They probably caused the cyclone. It all makes sense.
Yeah, so now we can blame them. We could be like, you gave us a tornado.
Right.
Well, let's move on to NASA's big announcement. I actually had some free time this afternoon to listen in on a live audio stream news conference with some NASA scientists. I think it was about a week or so ago, NASA said, we got a big announcement. We're going to be making it next week. We're not telling you what it is, but it's really big. It's something we've been looking for 50 years. So, of course, there was wild speculation about aliens and meteor going to hit the Earth.
Right, the hint is that NASA's
turns
only
out,
50 years old, too, so... There's a bit of a hint there.
It was none of that. And I know you guys all know by now what it is. But what we found was a recent supernova remnant in our own galaxy.
Wow.
Woohoo!
And not something that we actually have found before. This is G1.9. This is pretty much near the galactic center. So it's about 29,000 light years away. On galactic terms, that's close. That's nearby. And it is about 100 years old.
140.
Well, they said it's at most 140 years old, but if
true.
There was any acceleration of the expansion, it would be maybe a few decades less. So they're estimating maybe about 100, but 140 would be the oldest that it could be.
Okay.
So this is why this is cool, to sum up very quickly. On average, a galaxy of the size of the Milky Way should have about 2 to 3 supernova per century. And, of course, a supernova is when a massive star is at the end of its life. It can no longer sustain itself. It's burned up too much of its fuel, and it collapses in on itself and then explodes outward. You know, it could outshine a galaxy for a few weeks. So they're very bright. They're so bright that, of course, we could see them from far away. So if we look at any galaxy outside of our own, well, we see 2 to 3 per century, and of course, because there's billions of galaxies out there, we could see supernova all the time in other galaxies. But there's a limit to how much we could learn from extragalactic supernova, because while the supernova event itself is very bright, it dims after a year or two, and then it becomes too dim to see. We can't see the supernova remnant. So that's it. After a couple years, supernova disappear, and then we can't learn anything else about them.
Sounds like it's a cosmic flash sort of that goes off.
Yeah, right. So we want to see a supernova nearby so that we could see the remnant and see what happens. We want to see what happens a year, 10 years, 100 years after a supernova. There have been a few in our galaxy. The most recent ones were 1604 and 1572. Supernova were actually witnessed and in the record, Europeans and Asians, you know, saw the supernova and wrote it down. And we can go back and look and say, yep, that's the remnant of the 1604 supernova that they were talking about. But so now we're looking at remnants that are, you know, 400 plus years old. The youngest one that we've seen is 340 years old. So that's been the youngest supernova remnant. We also saw a supernova in 1987 occur in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And that's not our galaxy, but it's a small satellite galaxy of the Milky Way. So still kind of far, but not too far. It's, you know, it's in another galaxy, but it's a galaxy that's close to our own.
Pretty close, though, if you think about it. I mean,
pretty close, yeah.
170,000 light years.
Much closer to, say, the next closest galaxy, which would be Andromeda, which is 2 million light years away. But that's a huge gap. So we've been following this one for the last 20 years in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Then we have other remnants, the youngest of which is 340 years old. But we have no idea what happens between 20 and 340 years, or at least we haven't directly observed what happens. So that's what NASA's been looking for, a recent supernova remnant in our own galaxy. And now they have found it between 100 and 140 years old. They found it because it's a really interesting story. They had radio telescope images of this this star, this region of space. And then they were taking Chandra X-ray images. And they said, hey, let's do another X-ray image to overlap it and compare. And they did that. And they compared the X-rays to the ones that they had taken 23 years earlier and said, hey, this is expanding. And that's how they discovered that it was a supernova remnant, because it had only a supernova cloud would expand at that rate over that time. This one is expanding at about 5% of the speed of light, the shockwave from this supernova, which is really fast.
Very fast.
Fast for a supernova. Also, for some reason, they're not sure why, the radio signature is becoming brighter over time. Now, obviously, that's not going to continue forever. At some point, it'll peak and then dim. But they're not sure why it's brightening, why it's getting brighter.
Could be interaction with the local medium in
something.
In space.
It is in a dense part of, near the galactic center, so it's pretty dense there. They also said that this supernova would not have been seen optically because it would have in the visible spectrum it would have been obscured by gas and dark stuff because it's near the galactic center. So there's just too much material in the way. So we wouldn't have seen it optically, but we can see it with X-rays and with radio waves.
Steve, I read somebody could have seen it if they were looking at the right spot at the right time. With a decent telescope, they could have potentially seen it, but it would have been just one tiny dim star that appeared briefly for a little while amongst many other dim stars, and nobody did see it anyway. So
yeah, no, there is no record of it. During the news conference, they said it would not have been visible. So
okay, I read something different then. All right,
yeah. So maybe it would have been very, very dim. Maybe what they meant was that we would not, with the equipment we had at the time, we wouldn't have seen it. One funny thing happened during the question and answer session. One of the people who I guess had, I was just listening in, but you could have requested ahead of time if you were a member of the media to be able to ask questions. And somebody asked a very impolite question, and nobody knew what the hell he was talking about. He said, "What does this supernova have to do with moon crickets being shipped off the Earth?"
What? Moon crickets?
No, but yeah, everyone was like, "What? What's he talking about?" The astronomer and the person moderating it, and then pretty quickly they said, "We will, we can email you, or you can email us after the conference, and we'll address any of the questions that you have." But they just had to eventually just get rid of the guy.
Moon crickets?
At the time, I'd never heard that term. I had no idea what it meant. But apparently, it is a derogatory term for African Americans. Yeah, so just a racial slur. I mean, just ridiculous.
Nice.
Got to screen these calls better, I think.
Yeah, screen their calls better. They handled, I guess, as best as they could. I mean, they got rid of the guy pretty quickly.
Maybe he was on for the Howard Stern show or something.
What a jackass.
Who knows?
Yeah, what a jackass, exactly. Yeah.
Steve, I read that if this star was not obscured by dust, which apparently diminished its brightness by like a trillionfold.
Yeah.
But if it wasn't diminished, if it was, say, in another part of our galaxy, still 28,000 light years away, but say, on another spiral arm across from us or something and not obscured, that it would have been extremely bright, brighter than Venus and potentially even visible during the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, can you imagine
for a while, anyway,
a supernova visible during the day? That would be awesome.
The other interesting thing that he talked about was the fact that we're not sure why we haven't found more supernova remnants in our own galaxy. If you think 2 to 3 per century, there should be 20 or 30 over the last 1,000 years in the Milky Way, and we can't find them. And then no one really is sure why.
Is this a new tech? So the combination of these X-ray telescopes and the ground-based telescopes, that's a new technique they're using to find these?
Well, I mean, they've been using radio astronomy for many years and as well as X-ray astronomy more recently, but for a while. I'm not sure exactly how long. But the Chandra X-ray telescope, it hasn't been around for too long, hasn't been up and running for too long. But, the technology is getting better and better all the time. The telescopes are getting better. The receptors are getting more sensitive. So, we're able to see more and more. The next news item is an attack on evolution in Maine, which is unusual because the Northeast usually doesn't have to deal with this issue. Matthew Linkletter, who's the director of the School Administrative District number 59, says that evolution and the Big Bang Theory should not be taught in the public school science classrooms because both are personal beliefs and worldviews rather than proven science. So, this is, where have we heard this before, right? So this is the tactic that evolution is not a science. And he lumped the Big Bang in there as well. And he's just trying to undermine the teaching of evolution and the Big Bang Theory. He's not trying to insert the teaching of creationism or intelligent design. Which, again, we've been discussing. This is part of the next phase of the strategy here. It's actually almost coming around full circle. This is almost the originally creationists attempted to ban the teaching of evolution in public schools. So I don't know if this is a good thing that they've come around full circle. Maybe they're out of new things to do. But this guy gets it completely wrong.
He's not even wrong.
Which is incredible that he's at all involved in education, doesn't even understand what science is. And in addition, the board chairman, Norman Luce, is backing this guy up. He says that maybe we should teach this in philosophy class rather than in a science classroom. And he also said it's okay to have it somewhere, but it depends on how much time they're spending on it in the science curriculum. I don't care if everybody else in the country uses it. Science is about proving things. Linkletter has a good point. So it's not just one guy. It's at least two cranks up there in Maine who are promoting this. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. What's new about this is that it's penetrated to the Northeast, which is traditionally not an area where this issue crops up.
Can't we just smack these guys and just sit them down and show them the evidence? Say, look at this. Look at this.
But it's there. I mean,
God.
Apparently that doesn't help.
No, I mean in their face. I want to see it. I want to see them deny it in their face. It's so pathetic.
In their face, man.
they don't care.
Why do people even listen to these guys?
It's incredible that today that you could be an educated person. You could be involved in public school education and not have the slightest clue what you're talking about when it comes to evolution and science. Just incredible. And I was going to award this guy our Jackass of the Week award, but then I read something Ben Stein said recently. I know you guys have seen this.
Is that official?
Ben Stein gets the Jackass of the Year award. He was being interviewed for the Trinity Broadcasting Network, so he thought he was talking to believers. And listen to this quote. He said, "When we just saw that man, I think it was Mr. Myers, he's referring to P.Z. Myers, talking about how great scientists were, I was thinking to myself, the last time any of my relatives saw scientists telling them what to do, they were telling them to go to the showers to get gassed. Wow. That was horrifying beyond words. And that's where science, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, that's where science leads you."
Wow.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
You're a jerk, Ben Stein.
I mean, so this is not just like a blind spot for evolution. Ben Stein thinks that all science is evil and has a tendency to lead people to the gas
chambers.
What,
is he running for Pope or something? What? He is over the top, out of control.
Yeah, I mean, the only good thing about this is that he's showing his colors as an all-purpose anti-science kook. Then that gives him even less credibility.
Yep, exactly.
With the evolution intelligent design issue. Well, let's move on to a couple of questions and emails before we do our interview. The first email comes from Jake Hall from Florida, United States. Now, if you recall, last week we reported on the substitute teacher who was let go because of quote-unquote wizardry, because he cast a magic trick in front of his students. And we asked any of our listeners who were local, who were getting more of the local news, to tell us if there was any follow-up. So Jake writes the following letter. "Hello, I'm a big fan of the show and have been for about a year now. Last week you discussed the substitute who was fired for wizardry. I live near Land O'Lakes and have talked to people who were involved in the case. Steve said that it wasn't that big a deal for letting students use unauthorized computers, which, as it is stated, isn't. But according to teachers, he would simply let students play online games rather than following the lesson plan for the day, which could be costly considering the school's funding is based off the standardized test scores, which are prepared for more than actual learning. As for the wizardry, it seems that came from one offhand remark from the supervisor and was blown out of proportion by the substitute and the local media. Keep up the good work, Jay Call." Well, thanks for that follow-up, Jake. And that was sort of what we were talking about. What is this really as it was being reported, or is there more to the story? And it sounds like this guy, you know, if what you're saying is true, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is a little bit of hearsay, but if the information you have is accurate, he was letting his students play video games during the classroom. That would be a legitimate reason for not bringing the guy back.
Right. But the reporting of it was terrible.
Yeah, which is typical. We're getting very used to that. When you find a story behind the story, it just turns out that the primary reporting is always inadequate. Yeah. Well, let's move on to our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Martin Rundquist. Martin, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks, Steve.
And Martin is the author of Aardvarkeology, which is a skeptical blog that also covers archaeology and other topics. But so, Martin, why don't you start by just telling us about yourself and how you got interested in skepticism and all your other activities.
Oh, yeah. I'm a research archaeologist in Sweden, belonging to the generation born in the 70s. I don't actually have a university job yet. I have to wait for the boomers. Mm-hmm. But what sent me into the skeptical movement was actually all the anti-science sentiment I encountered at university, because I'm in the humanities wing. Mm-hmm. You know, in Europe, archaeology isn't part of the social sciences. It's a humanity.
And, really?
Mm-hmm. And a lot of my colleagues are pretty ignorant of science and not very friendly to it either. I came into my discipline at a sort of a bad moment when everybody was really enamored with postmodernism. Mm-hmm. Speaking to people in the natural sciences about the excesses of the postmodernists, they sometimes don't believe what you tell them, really.
Yeah.
You know, the nature of knowledge.
Tell us about the postmodernism, just for our listeners, so they know what we're talking about.
Yeah, this is actually a really old movement, but archaeology tends to be backward when it comes to new, cool, theoretical ideas. So sometime in the 60s, sociologists of science started to look at what happens sociologically between scientists and in labs. And they found that there was a certain amount of influence from these social and socioeconomic circumstances on what science was being done and what results were being taken out of the labs. And this is hardly surprising because we know that scientists are people. But a number of these sociologists, they took a pretty radical step. They decided that scientific results are not about the real world. They're constructed by social relationships among scientists and by their socioeconomic circumstances.
Right.
And this was a really hip and hot idea in archaeology back in the 90s when I got into it. So I got in touch with the skeptical movement.
Yeah, it's interesting that the whole postmodernist thing, it's basically, you know, a bunch of philosophers and humanities or non-scientists got together and decided that science was essentially complete bunk, that it was all about language and
yeah.
culture and didn't have any relationship with external reality. But that lasted, you know, only a couple of decades before even philosophers were like, well, maybe, you know, maybe this is not true and that maybe science is different, not just all culture and language. But so you're saying that that postmodernist ideas are still lingering within the humanities departments at universities?
Oh, yeah, the generation that was brought up on these ideas is sort of the ruling one right now. But,
yeah.
But there's a funny dichotomy in our discipline in archaeology, because 95% of everybody is out digging.
Yeah.
And that's a very empirical activity, very hard, mm-hmm. hard in the sense of very tactile, while 5% are at the universities, and a minority of them still sort of cherish these ideas.
So do you think that most of the archaeologists are going about their empirical science despite their postmodernist philosophy, that it's not really getting in the way?
No, they don't have a postmodernist philosophy. I guess it was an idea that had its time, and a few people invested heavily into it. They still have to sort of keep up appearances, but most people did not.
Right, because they just had no practical purpose to it, right? Didn't really.
No, it's a sort of a dead end, you know. Yeah. I often tell them that, you know, I wish I were a radical relativist because then I could just ignore you as a figment of my imagination. But I'm an empiricist. I believe you exist. I have to sort of deal with this. But I note that they always look both ways before they cross the street. So apparently they do believe in primarily reality.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's right. Give me some specific examples. What are the kind of belief systems that you encountered that were unscientific?
Well, you know, archaeology is a popular subject. A lot of people with no scientific outlook at all are into archaeology. So we get our share of woo. You know, you've heard of the Bosnian Pyramid and Erik van Däniken and the whole thing. But basically what... The big problem with humanities scholars is you have to wade through these reams and reams of jargon, because they love to introduce new terms. They love continental philosophy, you know, the split between continental and analytical philosophy. So we've got this one guy, he wrote his entire thesis about Martin Heidegger in archaeology. It's not actually about the past or about the archaeological record. It's about Heidegger, pretty much.
So who was that?
Heidegger?
Yeah.
Well, he's a big name in German philosophy. He was pretty popular among the Nazis.
And, I see.
He's considered completely impenetrable. Nobody really understands what the man meant. But that's sort of what continental philosophers do. They're not primarily interested in a clear communication.
Yeah, you're familiar with, I believe it was a physicist by the name of Sokol who wrote...
Oh, yeah, I'm a big fan of his.
Yeah, so he wrote a paper and published it in a postmodernist journal, and it was designed to be as impenetrable as possible. It was just incomprehensible jargon. And at the same time, you published a paper in, I think it was a physics journal, exposing the hoax.
Yeah.
Basically saying these postmodernists are so full of it, they can't recognize basically a bunch of gobbledygook from genuine work.
Well, his point was that they probably took his manuscript because it appealed to their political ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a lefty himself, and he said, I don't want the left to sort of spiral down into this kind of sloppy thinking. Of course, you may have read Intellectual Impostures. It's got an alternative title, I think. The book he wrote with his French buddy, Jean Brinkmann.
Mm-hmm.
It's great stuff where they're taking postmodernists apart, specifically on how they're using science or science-like jargon. You know, the mathematical constant I, the square root of minus one. Jacques Lacan, a famous French psychoanalyst, he once wrote that the constant I is equivalent to the erectile male organ.
Mm-hmm.
So, guys, you now you know what you got in your pants.
That's a new one.
It's a square root of negative one.
Well, it's imaginary, at least for some of them.
You're very active in the Swedish skeptical movement.
Uh huh.
So, tell us about that movement. How active is it? How is it very organized?
Yeah, in American terms, it's a small organization, just a couple of thousand members. But Sweden's a small country, population wise. There's only 9 million of us. So, I did some calculations. I found that. From a U.S. perspective, our association is like an organization with 80,000 members in the U.S., so we're pretty big. A lot of members are scientists and engineers and teachers, and a lot of members are middle-aged white males.
Yeah, that tends to be the profile for whatever reason. But there's one Swedish skeptical movement. It's not fractured at all.
Well, we've got a separate secular humanist movement. So there's a tradition in Sweden for non-profit organizations to be religiously unfettered, whereas the secular humanists obviously are strongly anti-religion. But a lot of people are members of both societies. Organization, we usually call ourselves Swedish Skeptics Organization in English. We publish a quarterly journal, of which I am a co-editor. And we cover pretty much the same topics as Skeptic Magazine or Skeptical Inquirer. I looked over the past couple of years, and there was creationism, cryptozoology, fringe archaeology. That's something I like. We did a feature on our Swedish astronaut. this guy named Christer Fuglesang, who's been up to the space shuttle. Mm-hmm. And he, after waiting for decades before he got his shot, and he's really huge in Sweden. He's also a member of the Skeptical Society, so we interviewed him.
Oh, great.
Quantum ultimeds, misused math, misdirection in stage magic. We had a magician write about that.
Martin, what about intelligent design? Has that made any inroads in Sweden?
Yeah, the only people who really know about it are either our very, very small group of fundamentalist Christians or skeptics. Mm-hmm. I think there may be... the number of skeptics and the number of fundamentalists in Sweden are on the same order of magnitude. It's both are actually fringe phenomena.
You know, that's not the situation over here in the United States, that's for sure.
No, I gather that.
We are definitely outnumbered.
If you had to pick a topic that was to Sweden what creationism is to the U.S., what would you go with?
Ultimates. There's a lot of alternative medicine, same New Age ideas as over with you. We got homeopathy. We've got anthroposophy.
What's that? Anthroposophy? That's not one that I'm familiar with.
It's an offshoot of the Theosophical movement. It was big in Germany and Austria. So they actually enjoy a pretty good high status in Sweden. Their architecture is celebrated, and they got a hospital of their own. And quite a few members of parliament are enthusiastic about anthroposophy. So we combat that.
That's when it gets dangerous, I think, when it gets to the government. It seems like that's the UK has a serious issue, I think, with alternative medicine making its way into actual law. Do you guys feel the need to kind of step up and fight that sort of thing happening in Sweden?
Oh, yeah. If nobody presents an alternative, then there's a risk that the politicians will swallow the bait. A couple of years ago, somebody installed these... water taps in the Houses of Parliament in Stockholm that pulled the water through a spiral, which would give it beneficial properties and make it more healthy.
Okay.
But we managed to blow the whistle on that and get them de-installed the weird water taps.
Nice.
So what was the idea, though? What was happening to the water?
Well, it was imbued with mystical power, of course.
Yeah.
Just through the spiral.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
Only if it goes up clockwise.
I suppose so, yeah. And if you're on in the southern hemisphere, you have to do it counterclockwise, I guess.
Do you guys have much chiropractic over there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My parents are into chiropractic. My dad told me the other day that his osteopath, that's a sort of a version of a chiropractic, had cured his pollen allergy. Uh-huh. It was kind of interesting.
Right.
I just hummed non-committedly. I've got an office in his spare room, so I don't want to
be too confrontational.
Rock the boat there too. Exactly.
Yeah.
Is there any pseudoscience or belief system that you think is uniquely Swedish or is dominant in Sweden more so than any other place?
Well, I'm a provincial guy, so what do I know? But culturally speaking, we're pretty much under the thumb of the U.S. We watch your TV shows. I'm a big fan of 6 Feet Under, and we wear blue jeans.
Right.
I think anything you guys get, we get too, only not necessarily to the same degree. And we don't have the whole fundamentalism in politics problem that you guys have, luckily.
Right, so we basically export our pseudoscience to Sweden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
All the good stuff comes.
But maybe it's a few years behind, like 6 Feet Under is actually over here.
Don't give away the ending.
You guys should be getting creationism in the next 4 years or so.
Yeah, we could have our first monkey trial.
Yeah, look out for that.
What's the predominant religion?
Oh, well, nominally people are Lutherans, but they're very lukewarm about it, and... people tend to be very wary of strong religious expression, but they're very, very wary of strong skeptical expression too. So I got this lady at the offices where I edit a journal. She wouldn't like it if I started praying loudly, But she doesn't like you when I tell her that mobile phone stations, cell phone stations, are no problem health-wise. So there's a national characteristic that they don't like tall tulips. Is that how you express it?
Poppies. That's an Australian term, though, not a U.S. term.
Okay, well, you shouldn't make too big of a splash in Sweden. I sometimes think that my years in the U.S. turned me into an American. That's why I'm having all this trouble with keeping a low profile.
Well, somebody's got to keep them straight, though.
Yeah, on the straight.
I mean, we're doing it over here. You're doing it over there.
Yeah, we can only do our best.
Martin, is there a connotation in Sweden for skeptics? In the United States, when somebody hears the word skeptic or meet a skeptic, they immediately think, oh, he's a cynic. So the word skeptic and cynic are kind of synonymous. Is that true in Sweden as well?
No, thankfully not. I like wearing our society T-shirt. It says "I am skeptical" on the front, and people like that. They laugh and they point at the T-shirt and ask me what it's about. So no, cynicism. It's not a word they use a lot in Swedish. They know what it means, but doesn't have the same connotations of something bad.
That's good. So the word skeptic in Swedish doesn't come with the same baggage that the English word does.
No. Somebody who's skeptical is considered thoughtful and smart.
Wow.
What is the word for skeptic in Swedish?
It's just pronounced slightly different. Skeptiker. It's a Greek loanword.
Oh, yeah. That sounds fancier. Mm-hmm.
Skeptiker.
We should put that on our T-shirts here.
Hey, Martin, when I was in Sweden, I had one of my friends who I work with, who's from Sweden, teach me how to say,
oh, really?
Welcome to Thule, which is the company I work for.
Thule is an ancient expression meaning the far north.
I didn't know that.
That's what the Greeks and Romans called Scandinavia. Ultima Thule, the farmost north.
Oh, cool. Well, I have something to tell everyone at work
tomorrow. Yeah, they'll be so thrilled, you know.
You should definitely make something up first, though. Say, oh, yeah, I found out what it is. It means cat butt. Why did we pick that, guys? Seriously.
So they taught me how to say, how to speak a little Swedish.
Oh,
God.
You ready?
Yeah.
Welcome till Thule.
Oh, that's not bad. That's not bad. Very good. Yeah,
thank you.
You sound like a bit like the Vietnam draft dodgers that ended up in Sweden back in the late 60s.
Well, Martin, you said you wanted to talk about some archaeological woo around the world that interests you. So tell us about some of that.
Oh, yeah. We often get to interact with people who are local patriots. They like important things to have happened in their area. So we've got this Viking town outside of Stockholm. Well, it's in ruins since 1,000 years. But this poor town gets moved around a lot by amateur archaeologists who announced that they've found its ruins somewhere else around the Baltic. And it's getting to be a running joke, really, that any parish with self-respect must have the town of Birka.
Mm-hmm. So you know where it is, but people still keep claiming to find it elsewhere.
Oh, its remains are very manifest. I mean, thousands and thousands of graves in the town cemeteries and 2 meters of culture layers on the site of the town. And we've been digging it for 200 years and finding amazing things. But still, they like to think that it's somewhere else and it moves.
So is there a belief system behind that? Do they think like that it's a conspiracy or they just ignore the facts?
Well, there's a conspiracy. People in Stockholm, the capital, are nasty people who don't give people in the sticks the respect they.
I see.
And the other thing we often encounter is people who are into the New Age. They really like ancient monuments, you know, Stonehenge, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So when you visit ancient monuments with sort of a tourist cachet, you'll often find little offerings, a bouquet of flowers, a couple of feathers, maybe a few crystals that these people sacrifice at the sites. That's kind of fun, really. And there's so good stories. A colleague of mine, Rebecca Montague, she used to work at Avebury in Wiltshire in southern England. Mm-hmm. That's the area where Stonehenge is, and there's this enormous mound from the Neolithic called Silbury Hill. And her task once a year was to guard the hill to keep hippies from scaling it on the summer solstice. She couldn't do this violently. She could just sort of walk around the edge of the thing and tell the people to please don't scale the monument because it's fragile. You know, you're going to erode the sides of it. There was this one elderly hippie lady who was really angry with Rebecca, another Rebecca, and told her, "I'm not going to let you keep me from suckling at the teat of the mother goddess." Then she huffily stomped up the side of the mound.
Wow, I think suckling at the teat of the mother goddess, that's the first time that's ever been uttered on this podcast.
So we'll have to go back and check.
Congratulations, Martin. That was our secret phrase. That was actually our secret phrase of the day. So
it's high time.
Congratulations.
That's the sort of thing we all aspire to, isn't it?
Martin, last year we talked about the Bosnian pyramids. Have you followed up on those at all?
Well, I've been looking a little at it. It hasn't been a big issue in Swedish media at all. This Serbian nationalist. No, is he a Bosnian nationalist? I get them mixed up.
I think he's Bosnian.
Yeah, he believes this mountain is a pyramid. And the thing that's kind of iffy about it is that he's been excavating and probably mauling a couple of Dark Ages cemeteries on the mountain, but nobody really knows. He's apparently quite popular with the local media because he says grand things about their past, but my colleagues in Bosnia, of course, aren't happy at all, the ones doing real archaeology.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it made big headlines here when it first came out, and then but it was pretty much just this at first small cadre of skeptics who said, wait a minute, that doesn't really make sense, you know, and then slowly it began to emerge that this guy was a total kook, and now it's dropped completely off the radar here, but I just had this feeling that in Bosnia he's still kind of a big deal because he was really playing off of the patriotism of, you know, finding these great pyramids in Bosnia.
Yeah. It's the same thing actually as the moving Viking town. People like to find pyramids all over the place. There's a good paper in a book called Archaeological Fantasies that came out a year or two ago, where they're discussing Greek attempts to find pyramids. Mm-hmm. So what they're finding are these tiny structures, like 15 meters square, and they're saying these are proto-pyramids. They're really tiny, but they're sort of, this is where we got the idea, and then the Egyptians built the big ones. But it's just...
Yeah. That's interesting. So it sounds like part of what you're saying is that every local town or region or whatever tries to use archaeology to establish something about themselves, their antiquity, their connection to ancient greatness, and it's really a source of local pride, and that fosters a lot of archaeological pseudoscience.
It does, but you can also argue that that's why we're getting paid as professional archaeologists, because people are interested in having their national pride raised. I think, though, that most people who are interested in archaeology have more of a scientific outlook. They want to know what actually happened. They don't want one is necessarily to tell them that the Swedes were great and that Atlantis was in Sweden, which actually a 17th century scholar wrote a big book about.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's in Sweden, next time somebody asks.
It's interesting, too, because, you know, as Americans, we really don't have that phenomenon here because, you know, we pretty much know when people arrived here, at least Europeans, at least most of our ancestors.
You used to keep all the Native American archaeology in museums of natural history because that wasn't history.
Right. That is the conflict going on in the Americas, or at least in the United States, is, you know, anything really old, of course, is Indian, is American Indian. And they're, you know, have been very aggressive in claiming their rights to anything, you know, that gets dug up out of the ground.
NAGPRA, the Native American Graves something. Mm-hmm. A colleague of mine, he's working in southern Germany. He's an American. And he once had his funding nixed by the local Indian tribe because they found it obscene that he would be excavating graves in southern Germany. And he was like, "But well, you know, these are my ancestors and I want to excavate them. That's what we do in Germany."
Yeah.
But they said, no, you can't have any money for that.
Yeah, that's incredible. They're really just imposing their cultural beliefs, you know, even beyond their own people, right, in their own region. That's interesting.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed from reading your blog is that you seem to have a lot of trinkets that you describe there. And so do you spend a lot of time walking around with a metal detector looking for little bits of archaeology?
Yeah, increasingly I have, actually, since a couple of years ago. Of course, the people who taught me to use it were amateurs, because those are the people who really know and are really good at it. Us professionals, we're just catching on.
Well, Martin, we really appreciate you giving us the time. And we started this interview, it was 3 o'clock in the morning your time. So
Great talking to you guys.
All right, thanks, Martin.
Yeah, thank you so much, Martin.
Take care. We'll talk to you again soon. All righty, bye bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, Martin.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week? We are
three.
We are themeless this week. We are themeless.
Themeless.
Oh, good.
Cool.
Right, here we go. Number 1.
Can't stand it.
Do it.
Researchers have developed a video game that is actually a research tool. Gamers will learn how to fold proteins and may help advance medical research. Item number 2. Researchers have developed a novel drug delivery system, genetically altered skin flaps surgically implanted over tumors to deliver cancer-fighting proteins. And item number 3, new research shows that natural selection favors parasites that actually make their host more fit. Bob, go.
Okay, a video game, that's a research tool. Gamers will learn how to fold proteins. How the hell does that help, learning how proteins fold? I mean, geez, they just figured out how to do that anyway, or at least at a rudimentary level. Okay, let's see. Number 2 here is, this is bizarre as hell. It sounds like something out of science fiction. New drug delivery system. Skin flaps surgically implanted over tumors. What's the idea? I mean, the skin flap is actually on the tumor in your body.
It's not a tumor.
And then drugs can be delivered through the skin flap, or is it actually on the skin, the outer part of your skin?
Yeah, Steve.
I think all the information you need is right there.
Surgically implanted over the tumor, so they're creating a skin flap on a tumor. Yeah, but if you can get the drugs to the tumor, then getting it through a skin flap, I mean, is it going to help that much? I mean, the problem is getting it to the tumor. Natural selection favors parasites that actually make their hosts more fit. Oh man, what did I see on that? Damn.
I know.
Never
pick
me first.
A pony and bet it, okay?
The natural selection favors parasites that make their hosts more fit. Something about that. I'm gonna go with the parasite fitness.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah. The first one about a video game that's a research tool makes perfect sense. Look at Grand Theft Auto. Mm-hmm. It's made great advancements in the fields of carjacking and hoe slapping.
That's what I thought of.
And pimping.
And pimping. Drug delivery system through skin flaps. Sure, why not? I don't know. That one I'm not sure about. But the natural selection favoring parasites, that sounds like you're trying to play into the whole myth that the only things that can survive are things that are beneficial. Sort of crap. So I'm going to say that's the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Yeah, I've this whole thing about the skin flaps has me flummoxed. I'm not sure.
You're flummoxed about the flaps.
These are genetically altered skin flaps from the host. They take those skin flaps, or a flap of skin, and they cut the subject open, and they implant the skin flap inside the person, they put it on top of the cancer cell, and then they close the guy back up. That sounds ridiculous to me.
Yeah, it sounds like a little skin band-aid full of cancer-fighting proteins.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. We haven't had a full house in a while, so I'll add to it, and I'll select the last one.
Parasites.
The parasites.
Okay, Evan.
So I'll just take them real quick. The first one, games, folded proteins, you know, people creating mad cow disease and whatnot over a game. That's really cool. Totally plausible. The next one is the altered skin flaps. That's too disgusting not to be true. So I think that's true. I will leech on to everyone else and go with the parasites as fiction. Get it? Leech?
Yeah, parasite. You got it.
Get it.
So, all right, well, let's take the first one. Researchers have developed a video game that is actually a research tool. Gamers will learn how to fold proteins that may help advance medical research. That one is science. This is http://foldit, or actually, I'm sorry, fold.it. This is a free program. I actually tried.
I'm sorry,
to play
is it 1993? Do we say the HTTP now?
Well, I mean, it's not W. There's no www. I wanted to make that clear. It's just fold.it.
Uh-huh.
I tried to play today, but it was down. I don't know if it's because there's an article. Too many people trying to do it. They said they're having server problems. Every protein has a three-dimensional structure that it assumes. It folds into a particular three-dimensional shape. So when you think about a protein's functionality, it's not just the genetic sequence, which then gets translated into a linear sequence of amino acids. That then, you know, string of amino acids then folds up three-dimensionally to form the protein. And that shape has to determines a lot about the protein's function. The folds and crevices and protuberances all give the protein its not only its properties but its ability to bind and to have very specific affinities. So there are some proteins that we have been able to sequence the genetic code, but we can't make them because we can't get it to fold up the right way. They do use computer programs to help with this, but there are so many different possible ways that a protein can fold that computers can't run through them all. So what they're hoping is that people using their intuition and learning, sort of with your three-dimensional, we're actually very good at three-dimensional pattern recognition and manipulation, that if we use a video game model where you're getting that feedback and you're constantly learning how to do better and better, that people may actually learn how to get really good at learning how to fold up these proteins and may figure out, how to fold up one of these really complicated proteins.
That sounds lame as hell.
I don't know. I wanted to play it and let you know, but it's not. I couldn't
play it.
That
doesn't sound right. So what? No, just because a human folded a protein a certain way, why the hell would that mean that that's how it would fold?
Bob, what's with the hostility?
I know.
I don't know.
You haven't even lost yet.
Well, Bob,
it just sounds ridiculous.
They know what the protein looks like, and they know what the genetic code is, but they don't know how to get from A to B. They don't know how to get from this string of amino acids and then force it to fold up into the shape that they want it to have at the end. That's the problem.
I know, but that doesn't mean that a human using their, their feelings and intuition is going to fold it right.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is an experiment. We'll see what happens.
I thought they had a breakthrough in protein folding, and they were able to actually simulate it accurately and at least certain classes of proteins. Wasn't that a news item in the past year?
Yeah, this is the field of proteomics, if you will, learning how proteins are not only made, but their structure and how that relates to their function is an active area of research. But there's still a lot to learn, a lot of gains to be made.
Isn't it just a matter of brute force computation and algorithms to figure that out?
I would think, but they're saying there's just too many options to do the brute force. The brute force method is not adequate to really big proteins.
Even with the petascale supercomputers that'll be coming online in the next year or so,
they didn't specifically address that point in the article I'm reading. But I don't know. We'll see. Maybe more powerful computers may make this obsolete. But right now, this is what they're going with. So we'll see how it works out. I hear what you're saying. You would think that a supercomputer would do a better job with this kind of thing, but they're thinking maybe the human brain, with its massively parallel processing and its affinity towards three-dimensional manipulation, may have an edge. We'll see. Let's go on to number two. Researchers have developed a novel drug delivery system, genetically altered skin flaps, surgically implanted over tumors to deliver cancer-fighting proteins, and this one is gross but science.
Yay.
Like I said.
Gross science.
So what's the idea here?
It's a good idea, actually. So the problem is that proteins you can't take orally because your stomach, your digestive system will just eat it up. It'll just eat it like food, So it won't get absorbed as a protein into your bloodstream and then be able to function. So the only way to give protein-based drugs is intravenously. And some you can give either intramuscularly or subcutaneously, but you can't give any of them through the gut. The problem with that is that for some specific protein-based drugs is that, that there may be a lot of side effects with that. So there's one particular cancer-fighting protein that they have to give intravenously, but it has a lot of side effects. It can cause some liver failure. So what they did was they treated cells within a flap of skin, and they encoded it with interleukin-12 or IL-12 so that the skin cells will actually be like miniature factories producing this protein. And then they surgically implanted over tumors in rats. So this was not done in humans yet. This is now that they completed a rat study, showing that the skin flaps would deliver the protein to the tumor, and that it would work, and that it would not cause the liver toxicity that giving it intravenously or systemically causes. So this was successful at the animal research level, and of course you'd have to go on from there to human research before it could be implemented in people. But it is a very interesting idea because of this problem of delivering proteins as drugs. So this is maybe something that will be incorporated into medicine in 5 or 10 years. All of which means that number 3, new research shows that natural selection favors parasites that actually make their host more fit, is 100% complete fiction.
Hokum.
Why are you so full of lies, Steve?
I knew it. I know
it's so my
easy.
Nature.
You lie one guy
Bob, shut
time,
up. You did
week.
Not know it. You took 40 minutes.
Guys,
yeah,
ready?
You still all copied three, me.
All four of us jump up in the air and do a one-handed high five. Ready? Right.
Okay.
Yep.
1, 2, 3.
I was a little off there, but
close enough.
That's lame.
The truth is that research finds that natural selection favors parasite fitness over host health. And this has been a question because parasites, by definition, are creatures that live off of another creature, and they derive something from their host without giving anything back. Otherwise, if you give something back, then that's a symbiotic relationship, not necessarily a parasite. And parasites, because they reproduce within the host – the host is part of their life cycle. They derive, their energy, et cetera, from the host. That they, if they were too successful, they actually could kill off their host, which then would, be a problem for them. That would impair the parasite's ability to survive and reproduce. So parasites always evolve this balance between being successful and, rapidly growing, et cetera, but not so successful that they kill off their host. And the question is, how does natural selection balance this, or how does it play out? What they did was they modeled this, and they found that the forces of natural selection actually favor the parasite becoming more fit, meaning being more aggressive, more and reproducing more and replicating more, even if that is at the detriment to the host's health. So the advantages to the parasite outweigh, killing off the host.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that nice?
I hate
it's gross,
parasites.
But nice.
I've been folding it for the past 5 minutes.
Careful.
Oh, is it up and running now?
This is very weird.
Oh, you mean that?
It's like you take a bunch of like twisted up hot dogs that have little things coming off of them, and you kind of bend them and twist them around, and then it's just the weirdest thing I've ever done.
Okay,
and that's saying
that was
something.
Descriptive, Jay.
I don't want to fold it anymore. This is weird.
Well, congratulations, everyone.
Thank you.
Of course,
woo. Jay, give us a quote. Oh, I almost forgot. Before you say your quote, Jay.
Yeah,
we did put up the survey asking our listeners to tell us what they prefer.
Yep.
Do they prefer to say the name of the person who said the quote before the quote or afterwards? With 61 listeners voting, 55.7% said they want you to say the name of the person after, 14.8% before, and 29.5% don't care. So a pretty whopping victory for after. So
wow.
We'll listen to our listeners, and you should say the name of the person after the quote.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. I have no say in this, or
that's right.
Right. The listeners have spoken.
Let's not forget the listeners who don't care. They're my favorites.
Yes, that's 29.5%. So
the apathetic army.
Yeah, we've decided that it would be bad for our podcast if the superdelegates overturned the will of the people. So we're going to go with the vote.
Well, what about the president making a decision?
Let's get this done.
Yes, I made an executive decision, and you're going to say the name of the person after the quote.
There you go.
I love agitation and investigation and glory in defending unpopular truth against popular error. James Garfield.
Wait.
Come on.
What?
You can't say the name like that.
I did what you wanted.
Wow. That is the equivalent of a podcast temper tantrum.
Yeah, that was childish.
I don't believe I threw a temper of any sort, Evan.
Jay, stop being a child and do the silly
James
voice.
James Garfield!
Thank you, Jay.
You know what else James Garfield loved?
What?
Lasagna.
You're a good sport, Jay.
And dogs named Odie.
But I have an announcement.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay, Boston Skeptics in the Pub is coming up. And I just want everybody to come. It's going to be on Memorial Day, but let's be honest, you people don't have anything better to do. Monday, the 26th, this time we're going to be at Tommy Doyle's in Harvard Square. Go to BostonSkeptics.com for all the info.
And Rebecca, you have booked us at a restaurant for Friday night at TAM 6. What's the restaurant?
Yes, I did pick a place. It's going to be Trevi, which is located right across the street, which I know in Vegas is not right across the street. But it's near the hotel. It's in the Forum Shops across the street, and it's I think it'll be good. Italian, so
authentic Italian.
What time?
A few complaints. I don't know what time.
After
what time you guys
stuff.
Want?
We'll have it on the schedule.
Okay. We'll announce that a little closer. But yeah.
Yeah,
Rebecca, I somehow don't think that they're going to have a warp core breach for us.
They'll have
you make
something.
Your own.
You know what they'll have? They'll have bottles of wine.
And an insalata.
That's good enough.
This
is
true.
That's all we need,
Squangili.
Jay.
You're right.
Thank you all again for joining me. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, Steve. Good
Steve, time. You're a good host.
Thank you, Jay.
Yeah, you're getting
the
good
hostess
this
with
okay
the mostest.
This.
Do a good job.
And you guys are an excellent panel.
We're going to keep them, right, guys?
For now.
For another month.
What have I done for you lately? Is that
yeah. Unless somebody you really haven't made any along. Really good TV appearances lately, Steve. I mean, we're getting a little like, what's up?
Yeah.
Any listener that hasn't voted for us on Dig yet, please do. Just do it. No reason. Just do it.
Dig it. Em. And we do appreciate all of the kind reviews that we receive, both for this podcast and 5x5 on iTunes. It has definitely helped keep our profile high on iTunes, and that I think more than anything else really drives new listeners. Most people, from the feedback that we get, find us through iTunes.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks again, everyone, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.